Me to Psalm 57. Psalm 57. Psalm 56 in the title says a miktam of David when the Philistines seized him in Gath. Psalm 57 in the title says a miktam of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. And so we have David in another circumstance as he has been in the last few Psalms. We're not necessarily following chronologically, although you could say that David, in this section of the Psalms, because it's his life, there are things that you can identify and connect and perhaps see a progression. This is for the choir director. It is set to, and you see in the margin, that phrase, Al-Tesheth. Talk about what that means. David here is setting it to music, and there's a theme here that I trust will be encouraging to us. Verse 5 and verse 11 are parallel. Be exalted above the heavens, O God, let your glory be above all the earth. And that is repeated. The same verses, and I think we'll see it as we finish the psalm and compare this with another psalm, are used in another psalm, in Psalm 108. And in Psalm 142, there's also a title that connects David's time in the cave with some other words that I think are paralleled here. So there's a number of things as you observe, study the psalm, you can compare psalms and see that this psalm has use in other psalms. And David, during this time in his life, was praying. He was seeking the Lord. David's life for us, I think in that way, is a very good pattern because he sought the Lord in trouble. He sought the Lord in triumph. And the good question for us is, do I? It's easy to search for the Lord and seek Him in trouble, but what about triumph? Do I give Him praise when I'm triumphing and things are going well? Let's read this prayer. In my Bible, it says, prayer for rescue from persecutors. And he's going to talk about them in the psalm. Another connection to the previous psalm, look at the words of verse 1 of chapter 56. Be gracious to me, O God. Here it is again. Be gracious to me. Psalm 57. Let's read through it. Be gracious to me, O God. Be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in you. And in the shadow of your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. I will cry to God Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He reproaches him who tramples upon me. Selah. God will send forth His loving kindness and His truth. My soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire. Even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue a sharp sword. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They dug a pit before me. They themselves have fallen into the midst of it. Selah. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing. Yes, I will sing praises. Awake, my glory. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your loving kindness is great to the heavens and your truth to the clouds. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. May the Lord bless the reading of his word to our hearts. Literally, Al Tasheth is do not destroy. That may be the tune, sort of an unusual tune, do not destroy. If it was applied to David, in terms of his own course of action, it was do not destroy my enemies in vengeance. If it was applied to himself, do not destroy me. And there's differences of opinion. It's just a tune name, it appears, but at some point it had a reference, it had some meaning. And you can see as you read through the next psalm title and the next psalm title that there's that tune again. So you've got, like the last song we sang, same tune, different words. Some would say the same themes, that there's a theme of rejoicing in God, in what God does. There's a tone of glorying in God, followed by a humble prayer of submission, seeking God. Let's just compare briefly. Look over to Psalm 108. Keep your finger here. Psalm 108. Verse 1, my heart is steadfast, O God. I will sing, I will sing praises, even with my soul. Awake, harp and lyre, I will awaken the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations, for your loving kindness is great above the heavens, and your truth reaches to the skies. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and your glory above all the earth. But then the psalm progresses with a different focus. So whereas in Psalm 57, that ended the psalm, this in Psalm 108 begins the psalm. Turn over to Psalm 142. In my Bible, the heading, and this is just an editor's heading, Prayer for Help in Trouble, a Maskil of David. This is the title that you would find in Hebrew. Maskil of David, when he was in the cave, a prayer. I want to draw attention specifically to verse 5. I cried out to you, O Lord. I said, you are my refuge. And then verse 6. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Those two phrases, or those two words, you could see reference to in Psalm 57. David said, my soul, verse 6, Psalm 57, verse 6, is bowed down. And he had said in the first part of the psalm, as he does in others, certainly, but my soul takes refuge in you, in the shadow of your wings, I take refuge. That one is a prayer. This one, Psalm 57, is both prayer and praise. When exactly was it written? We're not given enough specifics to know, but we are told that David was in a circumstance where his life is in danger. He's crying out to God, pleading for his grace. God answers his prayer, and then his heart just explodes with praise to the Lord. And he's talking to the Lord. Again, he's praying. This is David in his life's experience. He's praying to God. Do you? One of the blessings of going through the Psalms is not only are we given a pattern for prayer, but we're reminded of how critical prayer is to our lives. Whatever circumstance we might be, even if we're crying from a cave, and that's part of the title of the message tonight. Be exalted, O God, a cry from a cave. This cry from a cave began with David seeking grace from God. Be gracious to me, O God. But unlike the previous psalm, he repeats those same words. He's looking for God to show him favor. He knows he doesn't deserve it. None of us do. Someone has said there is no reason for grace but grace. Why is he asking? Not because he's good at all, not because he's done anything good, but just because God, in his nature, who he is a gracious God. The songwriter said, "Nothing in my hands I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace." Did you see that in the song we sang tonight? Helpless. I'm helpless without the Lord. Helpless look to thee for grace. Foul I to the fountain fly. Wash me, Savior, or I die. David is not praying for forgiveness here. He's praying that God would protect him, that God would come to him and rescue him in the midst of a difficult circumstance. And so his plea for grace is followed by his confession of his trust in God. You might expect that someone who's asking for grace is expressing that trust in God, but he says it directly, "My soul takes refuge in you." David certainly had other things or other people he could have taken refuge in at other times in his life, but here, and there's a question as to whether he's at Adullam or En Gedi, the difference being Saul came into the cave in En Gedi where David and his men were. At Adullam, he was hiding from Saul, not the same kind of circumstance. As I have looked at this psalm and tried to compare it with the other psalm and then also thought about David's life, I tend to think he's in En Gedi. He is fleeing from Saul in the cave, but Saul comes into the cave. And some of the things later in the psalm, in my mind, point to that. But David is not trusting in anything, not himself, not his military achievements or his own strength. And remember, Saul is big, but so was the bear. So was the lion. So was Goliath. But David's not trusting in himself. He's trusting in the same God who helped him defeat all three of those. He says, "My soul takes refuge in you." Look at the rest of the verse. He says, in a beautiful picture, "In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by." The image here is that of a bird that is protecting its young by its wings. This has been a familiar theme in the Psalms. If you've read through the Psalms, you know Moses used this in Psalm 91. Where he said, "It is he who delivers you from the snare of the trapper and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you may seek refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a bulwark." Moses wrote Psalm 91. Moses wrote the first psalm that we know of. How this came into Israel's possession, we're not sure. Did David know the contents of this psalm? It's possible. But regardless, he was able to apply that same image to his own circumstance, that he was taking refuge in God's protection, and that protection was like a mother bird shielding her young from some attack. Notice it says at the end of the verse, "until destruction passes by." David said in other psalms, Psalm 17, verse 8, "Keep me as the apple of the eye, hide me in the shadow of your wings." Psalm 63, verse 7, "For you've been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy." Isaiah uses this same image when he says of the Lord, "Like flying birds, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it. He will pass over and rescue it." So when the enemy is on the prowl and has a huge expeditionary force, 185,000 men, and is going to attack, what was God's response to the trusting Hezekiah? "I will protect you." Like a mother bird protecting her nest from any predator. David knew where to find safety. It was in the Lord. Calvin said, "There are seasons when we are permitted to enjoy the calm sunshine of prosperity, but there's not a day of our lives in which we may not suddenly be overtaken by storms of affliction. And it is necessary we should be persuaded that God will cover us with his wings." that you might need in your life, even right now, to find refuge under God's wings. Does God have wings? Well, no, this is an image to convey that truth about God, that He's a protector, and there's no protector. There's no defender like God. He defended Jerusalem from that huge army. And He can defend an individual like David from 3,000 men and the king who leads them in the cave. Achish had been the previous king that David was fearful of. He'd asked for God to be gracious. God had protected him from that. Now he's asking from Saul. He's placing his confidence in God. Notice what he says in verse 2. I will cry to God Most High, to God who accomplishes all things for me. So this plea for grace, his trust or confession of God's protection, is followed by another statement of his placing his confidence in God, his faith in God. This cry is an audible, loud cry. And who does he cry to? He cries to God, notice what it says, Most High. His enemies may be powerful. They may be in high positions. But they're not the Most High. And it is a wonderful thing to remember that we are servants of the Most High, that He is the Most High. Not only does He have the sovereignty, but He has the power. David believed that God, even though He was Most High and in heaven, could hear him from the cave. He could hear him in the cave. God hears us wherever we are. He heard Jacob as he crossed the river. He heard Nehemiah's one-sentence prayer in the throne room of the king. He heard Daniel in the lion's den. He heard Jonah in the belly of the fish. God can hear. He does hear. He'll hear you in your bedroom. He'll hear you in your car. He'll hear you in your closet. God hears. So I was thinking about where God hears. Of course, He hears us anywhere. I came across a statement in a book called The Hidden Life of Prayer. Some of you may have seen a quotation in the Prayer Daily from David McIntyre. But David McIntyre draws attention to a covenant which a doctor, a medical doctor, made with himself, where he's describing where he prays and where God hears, of course. He says, to pray in all places where quietness invites, in any house, highway, or street. And he said, and to know no street in this city that may not witness that I have forgotten God and my Savior in it. That no parish or town where I have been may not say the like. In other words, all these places giving witness to his prayers. That he had prayed in all those places. That he was seeking God in all those places. He says, to take occasion of praying upon the site of any church which I see or pass by as I ride about, to pray daily and particularly for my sick patients and for all sick people under whose care soever, and at the entrance of the house of the sick to say, the peace and the mercy of God be upon this house, after a sermon to make a prayer and desire a blessing and to pray for the minister. That kind of brings us right to where we are and think about prayer in this place. But then wherever I go throughout the week, wherever I find myself, even if I find myself in a place of distress, that place ought to be a place of prayer. And God will hear me. God will hear me. Because God has appointed that. The circumstance I find myself in that stresses me, that distresses me, is something He's planned for me. What does He say in the next phrase? He says, to God who accomplishes all things for me. To God who accomplishes all things for me. What was it about God that gave David such confidence when he prayed? Well, certainly that God was the Most High. God, as the Most High, gives victory over His enemies. If you see the very first use of that title in Scripture, it's as Melchizedek is blessing Abraham. And Abraham had just come from a victory over his enemies. And Melchizedek said to Abraham, this is what the Most High has done for you. That circumstance, that battle that Abraham was in, was God's plan, and God's deliverance of Abraham was a part of that. That may be in part why David is praying here as he thinks about the Most High who delivered Abraham long ago in a battle. Whether that was on his mind or not, it's still true. But David is also confident in God because he believes that God, one translation has, fulfills his purpose for me. In the Greek translation, the Old Testament, the translation would be God, the one who works good to me, or the God or the one who does me good. Finds a parallel statement in Psalm 138, verse 1, the Lord will accomplish what concerns me. Your loving kindness, O Lord, is everlasting. Do not forsake the works of your hands. In other words, this statement to God who accomplishes all things for me, David is recognizing in his circumstance that God, if he is to deliver him out of this circumstance, it was a part of his plan. Matthew Henry said, in everything that befalls us, we ought to see and own the hand of God. Whatever is done is of his performing. In it, his counsel is accomplished and the scriptures fulfilled. Now, this verse happens to be a verse that John Flavel took as the basis for a work called Divine Conduct or The Mystery of Providence. I don't know if you've ever read The Mystery of Providence. It's a great little book. And in it, Flavel draws attention to the work of God in the lives of his people, his providential work in their everyday life. He says this in that work, it's the great support and solace of the saints in all the distresses that befall them here that there is a wise spirit sitting in all the wheels of motion and governing the most eccentrical creatures. He means eccentric, strange, all these different things that God has made. He's governing them. And he says in their most pernicious designs to blessed and happy issues. And he says, and indeed, it were not worthwhile to live in a world devoid of God and providence. God is in control. He's in control of your circumstances. He's certainly in control of whether or not you're in a cave or not, running from your enemy. Flavel went on to say, the expression imports the universal interest and influence of providence in and upon all the concerns and interests of the saints. It has not only its hand in this or that, but in all that concerns them. It has its eyes upon every tiling that relates to them throughout their lives, from first to last. Not only great and more important, but the most minute and ordinary affairs of our lives are transacted and managed by it. It touches all things that touch us, whether more nearly or remotely. All things? All things? To God who accomplishes all things for me. What are some of those things when you think about your life? And again, I'm just kind of drawing attention to Flavel's work because it's such an encouragement to me. It's an encouragement to think about that whether it's a particular circumstance like this or the features of your life, God has a plan and in his providence, he's working that out. Flavel drew attention to the fact that God designed you in the womb. Psalm 139. God timed your birth in history. He says that of Pharaoh. You can look through the scriptures and see his plan for individual lives. He put you in the family, the place and time that you are in for his purposes. He brought you, if you came to Christ, when he did. And sometimes people look at the timing of their conversion and they wonder why, because of all the things that passed on in their life earlier on and they came to Christ later in life. No, God did that. God's sovereign in salvation. He brought you to Christ when he did for a purpose. He ordained your calling, your vocation, what you do for a living. He guided you in your relationships, your wife, your husband. He makes provision for you. Faithfully. He preserves you. in many ways, but Flavel drew attention to the temptations of sin that we face and that God preserves us through those as we trust in Him and He helps us when we fall and fail. His protection of you through sickness and dangers, His sanctifying of you in your life, all these things and more as God works in our lives and performs or accomplishes all things for me. Now, that's worth meditating on. I think that book is worth reading. Flavel comes to an end of that section as he's deliberated on all these things, and he says, I cannot but make a pause and desire you with me to stand in holy amazement and wonder at the dealings of God with such poor worms as we are. Surely God deals familiarly with men. His condescensions to his own clay are astonishing. God cares about me? To that detail? Do you know how many hairs are on your head? He does. Do you know how many steps you have taken today? Job says he knows the number of my steps. That ought to amaze us about God. That ought to give us confidence in God, in His wisdom, in His plan, in our lives. That He is working all things together for the good of those who love Him, to those who are the called according to His purpose. Why? Because those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son. God has a purpose for your life and mine. And the very distress and circumstance you find yourself in right now, if you're one of His own, He has a purpose to use that to shape you into the image of Christ. Would that we would believe that. Would that we would, instead of complaining, instead of crying out in anguish, not that we don't go through hard times, but instead of complaining, expressing our trust in the Lord. Even in the cave. I don't know what your cave is. But there are times when we're in a position of distress and we need to cry out to God Most High and trust that He is God Most High, that He has a purpose for this circumstance, that He is shaping me into the image of Christ, that He's cutting away, He's chipping away at what in my life does not resemble Christ. And for all of us, if we were a sculpture, there would be things to chip off. All of us. Some of us may be down the road further than others in life in terms of the sanctification, but there's not any of us who don't need to grow. Every single one of us needs to grow. And when you find the Lord putting you through a circumstance, a testing time, yes, that's time to grow. That's time for Him to sanctify you and me. And He will hear our prayers in that as we cry out to Him. And He will, what does David pray for here? He prays for God's salvation, but he is confident that God will send it. Look at verse 3. What else is David confident in? Not only that God is Most High, not only that God is in control of his life and ordains and accomplishes in His providence all things for him, but he says He will send from heaven and save me. Though David is in a cave and God is in heaven, God is not limited when He is in heaven to save someone who's in a cave. God is not daunted by thousands of people. The nations are as a drop in a bucket, according to Isaiah. So some little king with his 3,000 men, God is not daunted by that. And though David has men with him and could call upon them to help him. And you think about the circumstance that he was in. This references that cave where Saul came in and David's in the cave with his men. He's trapped. However many men he had, he's trapped. And to come out or to come towards the entrance of the cave, I mean, they could have just waited him out and let him starve in there. Set up a garrison and leave. And hey, anytime somebody comes out, kill them all. And they had plenty of men to be able to stop any kind of onslaught from those in the cave. David recognized he needed the Lord, but he also trusted in the Lord that God could send from heaven from heaven and save him, that God could, by a supernatural act, deliver him. Notice what he says. He reproaches him who tramples upon me. His expectation is that God would deal in justice with the one who, and you saw it back in Psalm 56, verse 2, my foes have trampled upon me all day long. Here again it is, he reproaches him who tramples upon me. There's some question as to whether the trampling is, the reproach is God or refers to the enemy, the reproaching enemy who's also trampling upon him. But whatever the case, in the verse, the first part of the verse tells us that God is going to deal with his enemies by saving him out of the circumstance. How is he going to do that? He's going to do that through his loving kindness, end of the verse, and his truth. His loving kindness and faithfulness. God, when we find ourselves in a circumstance when we need his help, he is faithful then too. He has been faithful before. He will be faithful again. He is always faithful. He is ever faithful. The question is, do we believe that, and are we seeking him to show that faithfulness? What does it say in Lamentations 3? The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Jeremiah goes on to say, the Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I have hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. And so David, as he prays to the Lord and expresses his confidence in the Lord, he expresses his confidence in his salvation, in his justice, and the end of the verse, his loving kindness, his truth. This is prayer. Prayer is not just about asking. Prayer is in part about confessing truth about God, giving praise to God. And as we confess that truth about God, what does that do? It helps us to grip on and grasp on to the Almighty and how good he is. Ask the Lord to show his faithfulness. Ask the Lord to show his loving kindness. Ask the Lord to show his goodness. And he delights to do that. So what is prayer? Prayer is in part this confession of truth about God. It's expressing confidence in God. It's faith in God. You can see David expressing his faith even while he's in a cave. Okay, this is a prayer in distress. A prayer when he is vulnerable, when his safety is jeopardized. And what's he trusting in? What's he proclaiming? He's proclaiming the goodness, the faithfulness, the loving kindness of God. He's also complaining about his circumstance. And by that, I don't mean he's complaining in a sinful way. He's just telling the Lord like it is. And that's part of prayer too, is pouring out our complaint to God, telling God our cares, our sorrows. What was David's care right now? Look at verse 4. My soul is among lions. I must lie among those who breathe forth fire, even the sons of men, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. I want to ask you to turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 24 for a moment. 1 Samuel 24. We tend to think, when we think of words like this, that it has immediate application to the enemies. And while I wouldn't say it doesn't have any application to the enemies of David, I want you to look at what's going on in 1 Samuel 24. Look at verse 1. Now when Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the rocks of the wild goats. He came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. Okay, so there's the circumstance. David and his men are in there. There's 3,000 men outside, a force that they could not have gotten away from if you just look at it in terms of manpower. Look at what David's men say to him. Verse 4, the men of David said to him, "Behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you.' And David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. It came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. So he said to his men, 'Far be it from me, because of the Lord, that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, since he is the Lord's anointed.' David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose, left the cave, and went on his way." Okay, what did David do? Well, David obviously took his life into his hands as he went out and cut off the portion of Saul's robe. But who encouraged him to do that? His own men. And then he had to restrain his own men when he only came back with a portion of the robe, because they wanted to kill him, because they knew that Saul would kill them. At least they thought that Saul would kill them if they didn't kill him. So when David says in, don't turn back there yet, but when he says in Psalm 57, "My soul is among lions, I must lie among those who breathe forth fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue a sharp sword," I don't think you'd have to go far from David to find those lions. Now, they were on David's side, but they were fierce. They were ready to do violence. They were ready to disregard the fact that this is the Lord's anointed. Now, there's more to the story, because as David continues and he comes out of the cave, look at verse 8. Saul's left the cave now. Verse 8 says, "Now afterward, David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, 'My Lord the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. David said to Saul, 'Listen, why do you listen to the words of men, saying, "Behold, David seeks to harm you"?'" Who was saying that? David's men weren't saying that. Saul's soldiers were saying that. So he's got men with him that are urging him to disobey the Lord, to strike the Lord's anointed. He has to restrain them. And then on the other side, as he comes out of the cave, he says, "Why are you listening to men who say that David wants to harm you?" That was never David's posture. And David has to convince Saul by showing him now the piece of the robe. But some of those men who were telling Saul that were probably right there with him, because Saul is not only jealous, but he's being stirred up by his own men. Maybe who were jealous of David, we're not sure, but there's obviously this swirling group of people around David and Saul, and it's not that those men are all right with God or good men. David just says, "My soul is among lions." And their main weapon is their words. Their words. Turn back to Psalm 57. I think that's the point. I don't think these men had extraordinarily sharp teeth that were spears and arrows. When it says their tongue was a sharp sword, that's obviously an image to convey something about their speech. That they were willing to destroy and cut and kill. It does seem that that could focus on the ones who were with Saul. But David is complaining to the Lord, "My soul is among lions." You might notice if you compare translations, when it says, "I must lie among those who breathe forth fire," another translation of that is those who devour, fiercely devour, closer to the image of a lion. Okay, but that's where David is. That's his circumstance. So not only is he in a cave, but he's in danger from the people around him, what they would choose to do. And what is David interested in as he's in this circumstance? And what should you and I be interested in when we find ourselves in such a circumstance where we're threatened we're in the presence of others who would do harm, perhaps to us, maybe to others, in disobedience to God, what should our posture be? We heard it this morning in Sunday school. Somebody said it. Whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. What does David want to see in this circumstance? He wants to see God glorified. Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth. And that may seem, as someone said, to be illogical. Commentator by the last name of Plummer said this verse looks like an abrupt and illogical change of subject. But pious minds, God-fearing minds is the idea, in the midst of their greatest sufferings, turn with readiness from themselves to God. David forgets the discomforts, or cheerily submits to them, asking that thereby the Lord may be honored. Lord, whatever the circumstance in this situation, I want you to receive honor and glory. Now, David has prayed for deliverance. And God is going to glorify himself in delivering David out of this circumstance. But it hasn't happened yet, at least as David is in it. He's then praying that God would be glorified in it, as he says, "Be exalted above the heavens, O God. Let your glory be above all the earth." What is he praying for? One commentator said, "This is a prayer, this verse is a prayer for God to reveal himself in his majesty and his glory in the exercise of his dominion in heaven and earth." In other words, since God already is the Most High God, this request is for him to do something that will make his exaltation clear to all. It is part of the prayer of this psalm for God to send his loyal love and truth to save his trusting servant. God's deliverance of his people from their enemies is bound up with his exaltation. Can you imagine the moment that Saul left that cave after David did what he did? They're all in the cave. Saul comes into the cave. David does what he does, takes the portion of the robe, comes back, has to stop his men. Saul leaves the cave. As I was thinking about what's going on, have you ever played as a kid hide and seek? And you're hiding in a place where somebody comes in and they're right there. And you're hiding and they don't see you. And you're just kind of not breathing. Right? And you're trying, if there's anybody else around, you're just like, quiet, quiet, quiet. And then they leave and you're like, oh. Well, that's such a minor comparison to a man who is facing his potential death. He could have died. His heart is beating fast, no doubt. But suddenly Saul leaves the cave. How could that have happened? How could that have happened? Unless the Lord had kept Saul from realizing that David was there. How could he have kept him while he was cutting the corner of his robe? How could that have happened? I don't know how it could have happened unless the Lord was in control. This is a demonstration of God bringing glory to himself by delivering his servant in a situation you have to say, there's no other explanation. There's no other explanation. And God brings himself glory as he delivers his servant. He does exactly what David is asking to do, showing David his loving kindness, showing David his faithfulness, delivering him again as he had just done in Gath, and he had done at his house, and he had done before that, and before that, and before that. Read through the end of 1 Samuel. There's deliverance after deliverance after deliverance. The faithfulness, the loving kindness of God. Why are those there? They're not for David. David's in heaven. They're for us. They're for us to read and to realize that God is a faithful God who shows his loving kindness to his people. And we can hide in him. We can trust in him. You can trust in God. The question is, are you? One commentator, as he was talking about the beginning of this psalm and comparing it to the last one, said that David was hiding in Gath, but in this psalm, he's hiding in God. Gath was David's imagination of where he could be safe. He wasn't safe there. Whatever you're trying to imagine as the place of your safety other than God, you're not going to be safe there. You need to hide in God. May the Lord help us to hide in Him. We will continue, Lord willing, this next week. But let's sing in closing. 608, Hiding in Thee. And let's stand together and sing praise to the Lord, confessing our trust in Him. 608, Hiding in Thee.